This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to Neil Baldwin, author and the newest biography of Martha Graham. Welcome, Neil, to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Neil, would you first tell us, give us some details about the book, where we can buy it, the publication date, and whether it's going to be on audio for our members?
Oh, yes. Well, the book is Martha Graham, When Dance Became Modern. It was published by Alfred A. Knopf on October 25th, 2022. It's available on all of the usual online as well as independent bookstore locations. And in fact, yes, there is an audio book, which just received an Earphones Award, which I'm very proud of. But the woman who reads the book, Gabrielle de Cuir is her name, Q-C-U-I-R. She sort of has a very sensible, learned, somewhat tongue-in-cheek way of speaking, and she's very theatrical, very histrionic, and she really, without imitating Martha Graham, she captures the kind of ambience of Martha Graham very well, and it's a very wonderful 19.5-hour audiobook, so that's out there too.
Congratulations. Your book has received a lot of great press, and of course we expect it to win many great awards. Can you tell us how you came to write the biography?
Well, it really begins with an epiphany. I would call it a visceral epiphany. I'm now emeritus professor, but I was for 15 years professor of theater and dance at Montclair State University out here in New Jersey, where I live. And although I have a PhD in American literature, my doctoral dissertation was actually on William Carlos Williams back in the 70s, 1970s. I was hired at Montclair State to join the Department of Theater and Dance and to work with the BFA performing arts students on their writing. their critical writing. I started out creating a dramaturgy program for the theater students. And then about a month into it, the chairman of the dance division, whose office was right next to mine, she came over and asked me if I would like to try and do some of the technique, if you will, that I was using with the theater students, come over and work with the dance students in the same way. And I said that I didn't have a quote-unquote scholarly training in dance, which is not to say that I didn't know anything about dance, but I was not a quote dance writer. But I certainly was a sentient being, and I certainly was a person who loved theatricality and loved young people and wanted to help them express themselves. So she asked me to just come and sit in on some of their classes in composition, technique, choreography, dance history, and just sort of be another pair of eyes, as it were. And then we also had a succession of the modern dance companies and artists coming in to set works on our students over the course of the year. And so the first rehearsal I went to was Denise Vale was there. She's the, as you probably, I'm sure you know, the senior artistic associate of Mars, the dance company. And she was working with our students on Steps in the Street, which is the iconic sort of centerpiece of Chronicle. And so I sat in the auditorium in the middle of the big orchestra there by myself, and I watched this. I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't really a rehearsal. It was kind of a vital embodiment of something I had never seen before, which is to say that these young women were dancing in a way that was at once unfamiliar, but at the same time breathtaking and stark and space-consuming and angular and visceral and built upon breathing and holding steps and carving, like making sculptures out of your kinesthetic experience. And, you know, this sort of sense that you're watching people dancing that know that they are dancing. And they were being revealed by the technique. The technique was an expository thing, and it was a visceral thing. And I can't emphasize that too much because it was all coming from my abdomen. I didn't know at that time how important that was in the Graham lexicon. So I left, I went out into the dark night. It was January. It was very cold. I was walking toward my car, the parking lot. And at that point, I was between projects. I had just published a book called The American Revelation, which was a series of essays about American ideals some years before. But I said to myself, I have to do something with and about this in the context of my, if you look at the sort of trajectory of my biographies over the decades, William Carlos Williams, Van Ray, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and Mexican mythology, Quetzalcoatl, and these American sort of biographies of signal figures. But the common thread is the modern idiom. So I was familiar with the modern idiom in other art forms, especially literary, but not in physical terms. And so I decided I would have to immerse myself in that and to cut to the chase. I mean, another 4 years went by, during which time I didn't tell anybody what I was thinking about. I just went to more and more dance recitals and talked to as many choreographers as came to campus, interviewed almost everybody, you know, from Camille A. Brown to Bill T. Jones and all kinds of steps in between. And eventually I screwed up enough courage to go meet with Janet Elber, who was the artistic director of Martha Graham Company in June of 2012. And I told her what I was thinking about. She gave me her blessing And I say that in, because it wasn't like a sanctioned authorized biography, but she told me she thought that I should give it a try based on my background. And then 10 years later, it was quite a journey, and it was just published. So that's, I know that seems like a long path, but it's a short version.
Thank you. Yes, I think we all come to Martha with that. I want to do that. It's something.
See, this is the thing. And this should be in our interview, Victoria, because I listened to your interview of your book, and you said exactly the same thing. And I thought, well, this is good because, you know, knowing your background and having that you are a dancer and that you are steeped in this knowledge, and you still had this seizure, as it were, then I thought, well, that's a good sign, because that's what it felt like kind of like I'm being called. I don't mean that like some kind of, you know, speaking in tongues or anything, but this is, I am supposed to do this.
Yes. Yes.
And you learned by that.
Yes. And, you know, it's very interesting because I actually got that from Ethel Winter, one of Martha Graham's dancers. And she said the same thing. She saw a Graham performance and said, that's it. So I think it's, you know, it carries through authors and dancers, perhaps musicians, I don't know. But you describe, you know, something that seems to be inherent to Graham. Tell me a little bit about the periodization of the book, where you start and why, where you end and why.
Yes. Well, I just got back from Pittsburgh. I went to Pittsburgh last weekend for 3 days. That's where she's from. That's where Martha Graham was born, as many people don't seem to know. Or let me put it another way. Whoever I write about, I have to go back to the origin. I have to go back to the spirit. What D.H. Lawrence, I first learned from D.H. Lawrence, calls the spirit of place, in which John Dewey and William Wallace Williams and all my other modern mentors, Ezra Pound and Marianne Moore, and this kind of, you know, generation of the birth of the new, is very wedded to the sense that you have to start by being connected to the ground from which you spring. And so I went to Pittsburgh way, way back at the beginning of my research. That was the first thing I did. And I went back there last weekend to give a talk. And the reason I stress that is because once you've seen, Martha Graham was from Allegheny, Pennsylvania, which is on the northern shore of the river, like further away from that core central city of Pittsburgh. And when Martha Graham was born in 1894, she grew up in essentially a little self-contained village of brick houses on the northern edge of Pittsburgh. And she was right on the fringe of the Allegheny Plateau. She was right adjacent. Her house was adjacent to a huge train depot that headed west, was a gateway to the west. And she played and sort of played hide and seek in the forests near her home in the unspoiled Indian trails nearby. And she was very, very tied into the weather and the landscape and the sort of sense in which she was living at the brink of the Western land. And I was very taken by that. And so my beginning with her was a spirit of place of where she was born and grew up. And I walked the streets that she walked, and I went to the church that she went to and the school that she went to. And she spent her formative years there. So that was a very important marker for me in terms of the American place and the sense that she belonged. And then the second thing that, so that's kind of the reason why I started where I started at the very, very beginning. And then just schematically, to capture the subtitle of my book, which is When Dance Became Modern, I did not decide at the very beginning that I was going to, quote, cut it off at any particular point. It wasn't like that. It was more that I went through a trajectory of a choreography, and I had to curate very carefully what dances I was going to choose. And because she did 180 dances in the course of her life. So I tried to find dances that were emblematic of the different phases that she went through as a choreographer. And finally, I will now like to answer the second part of your question. I'm just going to read you a paragraph from the very end of the book where I explain why it ends where it ends. And this would be about 1952. Return to health through power of will, adhering to the spirit of Schopenhauer encountered long ago, and a creative rebirth after diverging from Eric Hawkins, her husband. Martha Graham faced 40 years of immersive exploration among archetypes, mythology, romance, the feminine mystique, Americana, and satire, spanning from the cosmic to the intimate, revealing riches in concert dances beyond the boundaries of this book. St. Joan, Seraphic Dialogue, Canticle for Innocent Comedians, the epic Clytemnestra, Embattled Garden, Acrobats of God, Episodes, Secular Games, Cortege of Eagles, Lucifer, Acts of Light, The Rite of Spring, and Maple Leaf Red. And then it goes into your, the next paragraph is kind of like a segue to your book. Global ambassadorship and tours through continental Europe, the UK, Asia, the Middle East, and the Far East, et cetera, et cetera. So, but my point is that in terms of the repertory, and that's why I mentioned that very carefully chosen description of the different types of areas that she explored, the archetype, mythology, romance, et cetera. So I felt like by the time I reached this point in her life, she had explored and explicated these major categories of the kinds of dances that she wanted to do. And therefore, I decided to name the dances that were coming because they should not be ruled out. And hoping, frankly, and I've said this in some of my talks, hoping that this realm will, you know, as you have written about, that this realm will become more open to scholarship going forward, because the other subtext of the ending of my book is that, and I know you would agree with me, Victoria, that the shelf, as it were, the shelf on Martha Graham is still so woefully inadequate. I feel that intelligent discourse on Martha Graham, and I spent a lot of time, and so did you, and so did a couple of other people, but there's so much more to be done there. And you actually mentioned in your talk the opening of the archive at the Library of Congress and how you went in on that. And, you know, in the last couple of years, the Martha Graham Resources, which is the archive that was held by a Martha Graham Dance Company, was purchased by the New York Public Library in New York. And they've just last week, they issued the finding aid for that, which is now open. You know, you have to get permission and you have to sign up to look at it. But so now we're having another sort of huge publicly opened up archive of Martha Graham. And I just hope this is the beginning of a cascade of scholarship.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's fantastic, because just as my book was inspired by the opening of the Library of Congress archive, the Graham Resources Archive was closed to anyone who didn't have money while I was doing my research, which I wrote about in the footnotes. But I think by, you know, kind of running between Washington and New York, you'll have people, a scholar can have a pretty good sense of the woman. So, yes, I think that the opening of the archive, the resources archive, is a very good thing. I cataloged some of that information.
Yep,
sat on my knees in the Graham in the Graham studios, putting things into archival plastic because they were disintegrating, and so we're so lucky now that they've decided to give that over. It's very exciting. So tell me how, you know, there are the two biographies and the autobiography, and I, in quotes, of Graham, one, by, you know, what the critical, book by Agnes DeMille, who knew her, how did you use, some of these other resources, the truth of which has been called into question, not only by me, but by, you know, Lynn Garofola, and others. And again, it's through no fault of Agnes DeMille's, but, you know, many of the dancers give, everyone tells tall tales. So how did you work through what's already been written on Graham integrate that into your book?
Yeah, well, you all did another couple of people. Marcia Siegel wrote that piece, Marthology, for I think it was Partisan Review or the Hudson Review, one of those. And then Don McDonough, who died a few years ago, but who before he passed away, he gave me access to his papers at the New York Public Library. He wrote a similar article about, let's just put it this way, Martha Graham. I remember when I first started to listen to interviews with her, and Don McDonough, who wrote the book in 1970, it's the first sort of attempt at a full-length biography, and it holds up very well. Really, a very good book. But she finally, under great duress, granted him an appointment to come to her apartment, and she gave him one interview, which is like just shy of an hour and a half, which I listened to New York Public Library, and I think it's emblematic. The reason I'm mentioning it is because it goes to your question. The window was open, and there was a sound of traffic going by, and horns honking, and wind. And she had a drink of some kind. She had a glass. Well, there were ice cubes clinking around in the glass, and she would every so often she would get up and leave where they were sitting. You know, it was done on like one of those little reel-to-reel cassette tape recorders, probably. And she would get up to go get a piece of sculpture or a book to show to him, and she would walk out of the room, and there'd be this long hissing sound while she was puttering around out there. And her answers were very, I hesitate to use circumspect. It's not exactly the right word. It's more, they were cloudy circumspect. They were kind of like encased in a fog, and their references, they sort of time-based references, were very, very intuitive and off. That's number one. Number two, Blood Memory had the same effect on me, motivational effect on me, that Man Ray's by autobiography, Self-Portrait, which was called when Man Ray, my second book. Well, I start with the first book, William Carlos Williams' autobiography, also inspired me, and Man Ray's autobiography, because in both cases, they were written in extremis, and they were written sort of from top of mind, and they were also written from the point of view of somebody wanting to create a persona in his own terms. And Blood Memory, when I read that, like way back at the beginning, that was just another sort of addition to the recipe of motivation for me, because it was a kind of like a collage. Actually, Martha Graham's Gilded Cage, that's your essay, right? Okay, so that, I agree with what you say there, because when I was reading this, I felt like it was a taste up, like a, each thing in and of itself had some degree of interest, but there was no narrative through line, and there was no consistent voice, and there was, and the juxtapositions of occurrences sort of like surreal in a way, kind of like to go from A to C and then back and then to B and then L and such and such and such. And then, you know, the procrastination, the long period of time that it took. Okay, that was that. And then with DeMille, okay, so what happened with DeMille was a little more interesting, and I give credit to her, because with DeMille, what happened was I was doing research on her encounters with Martha and how she tried to get into the company. Well, first her upbringing and her ballet and her showbiz aspect, which was a warning sign to me in terms of when she encountered Martha from a more of a showbiz background. And then when she tried to get into the company and she never let her in, and she told her to go up and, you know, you'll learn more by yourself and et cetera. So first I read that. And then in the New York Public Library, there was an archive of Agnes DeMille's work papers on her book, which I looked at. And that's where I got the first sense of emotionality and the emotional conflict, which is not necessarily bad in a biography. And I have to just footnote myself. I don't mean to, I think this really is important, because when you're writing a biography, you do get emotionally connected to your subject, and you do find yourself sucked in, and you find yourself wishing that you could talk to the person, and you end up with all these imaginations and fantasies. And Agnes DeMille's notes were filled with struggles of when Martha Graham and she started to grow apart, and she couldn't get her on the phone, and Martha Graham started telling other people not to talk to her, and then she basically shut her out. And then she basically had to decide Agnes had to decide there was too much baggage, and she would just have to wait till Martha Graham died before she published the book. So this is not to take away from the, I feel there's a certain very poignant, alive feeling to a lot of the way that Agnes DeMille describes Martha Graham's life. But on the other hand, it's interfered with by this sense that the person who's writing it is having such a deep-seated conflict about her own affections or disaffections with Martha Graham. So I really love the book. I enjoyed it. It was fun. There were some great little vignettes of Louis Horst and Martha Graham in there. But again, I guess I felt like it wasn't, I don't mean this to sound, I felt like it wasn't up to my scholarly standards, quite frankly. I mean, you have to tell a good story, but you also have to get the facts straight. So that's kind of my feeling about these various other things that are out there and how I approached my own book, because I often feel like my biographies are, and Edison was the same way. Thomas Edison was a corrective. And I think Edison is a good analogy to Martha Graham, because I said of Thomas Edison, I said his own persona was his greatest invention. I feel that a lot of that applies to Martha Graham too. And that you want to honor that. See, you want to honor the persona that the person wants to have themselves known by, but you also want to sort of get it straight to the outside world, who hasn't bought into the mythos and hasn't been a dancer and hasn't heard all the other stories. Both things have to be honored.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Well, that's great. I think that's very, very interesting. You know, one of the things that has driven me away from writing any kind of biography of Graham was just, for me, the sheer volume of factual, how can I call them, you know, kind of breaks in the road, you know, and even, you know, even the date of first performances and, you know, who was the first one to take over one of Martha's roles. And I mean, you know, everybody, who was the first person to get Clytemnestra, you know, everyone's got a different story and it takes a lot of footwork and needlework, shall we say, to parse together the truth or the factual truth, right? So how, you know, when you found that one person had said one thing as a fact and another person had said something else as a fact, and then you found a third thing that was factual, how do you cope with the weaving, the interweaving? Because people don't say things that aren't true purposely. They have the, you know, they have their own agenda, right? So how did you deal with that as their biographical story versus Martha's biographical story, but then they were all interwoven, right?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question. I'm going to start, I'll just give, the answer I will give is based upon this apocryphal statement, movement never lies, you know. Movement never lies. So I went back and I won't go into the book. It'd take me too long to find it right now, but I went back to find as many iterations of that statement from as many different people as I could intentionally. And I made that part of the story because I told the story of the phrase movement never lies. Just so for those who are listening, of which there are many who are not familiar, one shouldn't make these assumptions. So her father was a physician, and he was actually an alienist, which is a sort of antiquated word for a psychiatrist. He worked in an asylum in a big hospital north of her home. And he worked with, I guess we would call them people with emotional disturbances of the time, and which was treated much more differently then than it is now. If you realize that, I mean, when Interpretation of Dreams was published in 1899, Martha Graham's father had already been practicing like a form of psychiatry for 15 years. So that's where he was coming from. But anyway, so one time they had a young lady come home with, I guess she was a patient that Dr. Graham was consulting with, and she was in his home office, and then they were having dinner as a family, so he invited this young lady to stay for dinner, and Martha, a little girl, she noticed that the young lady moved her body in certain ways, and it just seemed kind of strange to her, and after dinner, her father, you know, she talked to her father about it, and he explained to her how you can tell people's feelings from the way they hold their body. I guess it'd be kind of like kinesthetic awareness or body language of today. Anyways, so she said that never left her. And I think that the core of that is very good because it helps explain a lot about her technique. But as the years went by, that phrase became mutated and transformed. The body tells the truth, and you know, movement is a way of being, and all these kind of more things and mutations of this, depending on who you talk to. So I sort of put that at the very beginning, so that later on, when I talk about the reactions among the core of these very highly embodied, strong women of her company, which was all female until the, shall we say, intervention of Eric Hawkins in 1937, I landed on that as a way to show how the women in her company reacted to his arrival, and how there was a tremendous range of mostly animosity toward him. And so there was that, as you say, disruption in the road. I think that was a very big disruption choreographically, emotionally. You know, everyone got very jealous because Martha, we were losing Martha, and she was moving away from us. She didn't belong to us anymore. And why did she have to mess up this sisterhood and all these things? So that thirdly, when Martha Graham was partnering with Eric Hawkins in Paris, and she hurt herself, and I'm using it in that way because she hurt her knee, and I came into it with this backlog, again, sort of against Eric Hawkins, that he was manhandling her, pushed her around, and dropped her on purpose, and all these things. And I felt like that has to be included, yes, but that is not the actual, there I really went out of my way to find the actual occurrence and what actually happened that night when he was lifting her, because they've done it 100 times and they all felt what they were doing. And she says she landed slightly more awkwardly on her leg, and that you know, that it wasn't an intentional grievance being acted out as if Eric Hawkins was adhering to some kind of typecasting as the guy who came in and disrupted the company and was kind of like bull in the china shop and ruined Martha Graham's balance and caused her to become depressed for 3 or 4 years. And all of that was kind of laid at his doorstep. I mean, I think what I'm trying to say, Victoria, is that I told some of these apocryphal stories, I felt they should be told like in a Rashomon way. You know, Rashomon is my go-to for that, because by that I mean a story that is told in 5 or 6 or 7 different ways, going around the actual occurrence and getting all the different prismatic points of view. And then I arrive at what I feel, based upon my survey of the evidence, as it were, of what really happened. So both have to be included, because that adds to the understanding of what kind of a person Martha Graham was, because you see, she had a public face, a public facing face. She had a stage, you know, made up, projecting theatricality face. She had a classroom facing face and métier way of doing things. She had I talked to Yuriko, who just recently passed away, Yuriko Kikuchi, who was one of her big stars in the 40s. And she said to me that, I said, well, you and Martha were very close. And she said, well, I never forgot this. She said, we were friendly, but we were not friendly. She said she treated us like we were different colors on her palette as an artist, and she used us for different purposes. But there again, and just to add one little point to this. So another thing that struck me about different versions of things was the number of times that different dancers in different interviews from her vintage years, like 29 to 48 or so, who talked about how they would be rehearsing a piece and like Anna Sokolow or some iconic dancer would, I'm thinking of Anna Sokolow in particular, because she said that she made a movement and Martha stopped everything and said, okay, everybody, you see the way Anna did that extreme movement. We're going to keep that. I want you to keep that. We're going to take that. We're going to keep that. So although Martha Graham was the choreographer of the piece, she would often make use of a movement that came from the bodies of her dancers and integrated into the piece. And the number of those kinds of stories are very important, because that showed me how these women were honored on a momentary basis by her from time to time, and they never got back. That's like the thing where you said you were seized by it and I was seized by it. Well, the number of times I've heard people say, like Janet Elber, told me the time that Martha saw her, she said she was sitting in the back. She was at Juilliard. She was shy. And she was like 1970 or something like that, way back then. And she didn't want to get too close. And then they started moving around. And Martha Graham did that. You, back there. Come over, come up here. Show us what you just did. And that was, and she's 50 years later. She's still there. I'm just remarking on what that must have been like.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I think all of her great dancers have those moments where she said, you, right? I had a moment when I was in class with her and she pointed at me and she said, where have you been? And I had actually, it was in the 70s and I had been studying on the side with Bertram Ross, who had been summarily tossed out. And I must have done something that reminded her of Bert. I mean, it was absolutely, I will go to my grave remembering that moment when I was picked out. So I think that's a wonderful way to look at these problems. You know, you mentioned the kind of the elephant in the room with her talk with Don McDonough. Don's book was wonderful, and I think and he was so generous with me as a scholar. You know, I came to him knowing nothing, and he was just incredibly generous, as was his wife. A real loss, but one of the questions is what one of the things that he stayed away from very distinctly, and I had to use just because I went into later years. The issue of the ice, the glass with ice clinking in the background. She writes in Blood Memory that that when she really started drinking was after Eric and the fall. She doesn't say the fall, but she says it was Eric. How do you come to terms with that? Your book ends before she puts down alcohol. I think there are all sorts of ideas about, you know, I certainly saw things on the tour that would lead me to believe that she had it somewhat under control in the 50s. How do you deal with it, or do you not need to?
I think what I tried to do, because my sort of literary provenance came to the fore when I was at the Library of Congress and I was given access to the entire correspondence between Eric and Martha when they were, quote, breaking up. And the title of my chapter, The Breakup, I have the words breakup in quotes. I was thinking about F. Scott Fitzgerald's book, The Breakup. But when I wrote that chapter, I put breakup in quotes because I tried to get behind. It's very, very hard. I've never, you know, none of the books I've ever written before I've had relationships, husband and wife relationships and lovers and, you know, various kinds of interpersonal relationships in my other books, but I never came across something that was almost like a palimpsest of layers of different tissues of meaning that just get more and more complicated the deeper that you went. So it was very laborious, but that doesn't make any difference because that's something I shouldn't have just said, because nobody reads a book because they think it's so laborious that that's when you should read it. Oh my God, they put so much work into it. That's obviously not why people read books. But anyway, so I took all of these letters and I tried to make a journey through the separation of two people that I feel, as I'm talking about it now, I feel very strongly was extremely ambivalent separation. Let's say, you know, it didn't really start with the injury. It was almost baked in from the moment they started getting together, the moment they started having an affair with each other. Because the issue I struggled with the most, and I talked to a lot of dancers about this, partnering, because, you know, you have the artifice of partnering on stage where you have, you're acting, and theatrically, you're playing a role of, let's just say, lovers, So you're playing that role and you're, quote, in love with the character. This character is in love with the other character. And then you add to that the layer that the male character in this ballet, in this dance, has been choreographed by the partner he's dancing with. The woman he's dancing with, who he's a partner with off stage, is also the person who constructed the dance that he is, quote unquote, acting in. And so the traditional role, the support role, is already being inferentially undermined by the female choreographer, who believes most strongly in female empowerment. And so even though he's the male, she views herself as the driving force of the performance. So you have that. Then on the part of the male, Eric Hawkins, having read his journals, I know how insecure he felt about that, coming off of Balanchine, where when he was with Balanchine, he was being encouraged by him and by Lincoln Furstein because of his robust physique and how beautiful he looked and how statuesque he was. So he broke from them because he wanted to basically, quote, do his own thing. And they told him maybe he should go seek out Martha Graham because she was teaching a June course. Maybe you should try that. Anyway, so then you add up into that mixture, you add the fact that Eric Hawkins at the very same time was writing sketches for all these other dances that he wanted to do with these very strong male protagonists, where he would be the leader and she wouldn't even be in them at all. That was in his dream life of being a dancer. So I guess I'm saying that the dance of life and the dance on stage interpenetrated and complicated each other. And I feel that that is the most poignant part of it. I guess I've used that word already. I would say the most unresolved part of the story, because toward the end, she was writing to him that she said, you know, feel free to come and see me, but don't feel obligated. Perhaps you should keep on teaching the students, because she knew that Eric Hawkins liked working with the young people and he was such a good role boys who were getting into dance. So there was a huge swirl of conflict for their entire relationship. And that's how I left it.
You know, one of the things that I saw in Bertram Ross's papers was the funniest quote, which was Martha saying to Bert, I've never had better sex than with a gay man, which is, I think, just phenomenal. What do you do with the questions of sexuality between the two of them?
What do I do with the questions of sexuality? Well, I think the questions of sexuality between a lot of the people that I write about, that's a good example of another dimension of dance writing that is very, very open to more exploration. Because I think that a lot of the tension, the sexual tension that you feel when you're watching a dance on stage comes from this necessity. As one of the dancers I talked to, Oliver Tobin, the head of the resources and was also danced in the company, one time we had a long talk about dance love on stage And Oliver was gay, and many of his colleagues were gay, and they had to be in the position of portraying romantic heroes. And it was a big challenge, but to meet the demands of the choreography, that's what one has to do.
Interesting. So in terms of, you know, Martha Graham as a figure, she used to be, the Gardner book equates her with Einstein and Picasso. She was known as the high priestess and the first lady of modern dance. She had a postage stamp, for goodness sake. She used to be, an icon. But now, do you find yourself having to explain who she is?
See, now this is why, and while you were asking that question, One day I realized that I had been writing about a woman. Yes, in terms of her, shall we say, artistic persona, was a singular force, and all the pictures of her by herself, sort of being herself, with like even the cover of my book, she's kind of like has this aura of light around the Ekstein photograph. And yet, when I looked at all the different collaborations and all the different artists and writers and painters and composers that she either worked with, read the works of from like cover to cover, or actually was inspired by their words, by T.S. Eliot and Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, just to name three off the top of my head, and all the composers that she met with, who had to come to terms with her desire to make the dance and the music be more equivalents. And I realized that she was one of the most chronic, collaborators and researchers and filament sending outers of modern times. And that is what I wanted, another through line of my book, is to show her emotional and intellectual and collaborative allegiances with so many other modern figures. I'm just going to very, very quickly be just a few examples of some of these relationships that I talk about in the book, starting with Kandinsky, who was, and my belief is that Kandinsky is a much better analogy for Martha Graham than Picasso. That's just what I think in my beginning. I talk about that. Imogene Cunningham, Stuart Davis, Marcel Duchamp, Walker Evans, Isamu Noguchi, Edward Weston, Frank Lloyd Wright, composers Samuel Barber, Ernest Bloch, Carlos Chavez, Aaron Copland, of course, Henry Cowell, George Gershwin, Paul Hindemith, Eric Satie, Ned Warham, Arnold Schoenberg, Virgil Thompson, writers and poets Mark Twain, Charles Baudelaire, Joseph Campbell, E. Cummings, T.S. Eliot, Lincoln Kirstein, Thomas Mann, Harriet Monroe, Marianne Moore, Frederick Nietzsche, Ezra Pound, Dylan Thomas, Walt Whitman, William Carlos Williams, Virginia Woolf, and so on. I mean, at one point, I decided, I guess I was writing about Dark Meadow, which is one of the deeply archetypal ballet dances, and I thought that I would like to try to replicate her research methodology for just one dance. Because as I went through her corpus of work and I read her journals and her letters and her notes and her instructions to the composers and so forth, I thought about an image of a cornucopia with this huge gaping opening at one end and tiny, tiny little outcome at the other. You know, as Doris Humphrey used to say, all dances are too long. And but Martha Graham would spend, she wrote down the call letters to books from the library that she took out by the armful and brought back to her apartment to do research in for these various, these dances. So I took Dark Meadow and said, I'm gonna try to replicate her research agenda, as we say in academe. And after about 4 months, I said, you better drop that simulacrum because you have to write a whole book of your own. But it just gave me a sense of how learned and how erudite and how omnivorous a reader she was. So yeah, the fact is, to go back, and this is by a roundabout way of answering your question, because a lot of people, it kind of stops with the description that you gave at the beginning. It's kind of like, oh yeah, the Statue of Liberty. I've seen that. And, you know, it's kind of, she even looks like that in a couple of my books. I mean, she has one hand raised up. You know, it's kind of like this, like a colossus stride the dance world with her legs spread and her arm up reaching toward the heavens or whatever. Oh yes, Martha Graham, you know, kind of like, oh yes, a statue. Oh yes, an icon. Oh yes, she was really a great figure, you know, but that's fine. But I'm telling you, Victoria, there's so much more. Well, you know this already, but I'm just speaking to the wider role. And one of the reasons I wanted to dive into this was to show her connectedness with this milieu and period of the growth of making it new in culture in the 20th century. And she's an integral player in this. She's the connective tissue for me between all of them.
That's great. That's phenomenal. So in the few minutes we've got left, two questions. One is, you know, what do you want to say that I haven't asked you about? And the second is, of, you know, it seems as though your book has a number of reader bases. And, you know, what do you want each reader base to get out of the book? How do you want people to come away from your book?
Thank you for asking that. It's really generous of you to come around to that, because I think that is a question that if you ask any, dare I say, artist, they're going to have to take a deep breath. And because, as you know, as a writer yourself, and that's how I'll answer the question, because every book I've written it because I wanted to do it. It wasn't like one should do it, or it needs to be, you know, there needs to be another book on this subject or that subject, because that's not enough to launch upon something, especially when you take on a very big figure. And what happened with this book, and I haven't mentioned her now, but I will, my editor, Vicki Wilson, Victoria Wilson at Knopf, was with me for the whole decade. And at one point, she said to me, you have to take the reader in hand. Because, and this is to answer the second part of the question about who it's for. You know, you get so immersed in your mission to do the thing that you temporarily, in my case, forget that your number one goal is to tell a good story, but it's nonfiction. So it has to be a good story, but it has to be bolstered by factual information, which in and of itself, you know, is not that galvanizing. You have to galvanize, you have to synthesize the facts so they become galvanizing, but they also remain true to the life. And the number one, I would love it if people came to the general reader, who I like to think of, like a fairly educated, fairly cultured, but not, you know, inordinately or obsessively, a person who's interested in the human condition, as I like to say. A person who likes people and likes human nature and is intrigued by what makes people act and say and do the things that they do. And also a person who's interested in the imagination and how people have to find different ways to express themselves. So that kind of person would come to this book with an open mind, and they would have an intrigued curiosity about this person. And then by the end, they would feel like they had come to know that their life had been added to by coming to know the person in sweat, that they now could go back. Maybe they would go back. They don't have to be a dance aficionado, but maybe they'll go back and try going to some things that they wouldn't go to. Or maybe when they go to a museum and they see some of the artists I mentioned and they look at them in a different way, or they hear music by the composers I write about and they think of them in a somewhat different way in terms of a different perspective on them. That's what I would really love to have happen. And I think in terms of anything else that I might speak about that we haven't spoken about today, I think the thing about Martha Graham, this might sound like a contradiction, but she was a tremendous inspiration to me as a writer, because I often felt like I was in the thick of it, and it was quote unquote too hard, and oh my God, I'm never gonna make it, and so the feelings that all artists or writers I speak of most intimately have that feeling. But then I thought, well, look what she did with no money and very humble living conditions, as one room apartment in Greenwich Village with old burning stove and a little cot, no real furniture and no real kitchen or anything like that. And she just went ahead and did what she had to do because it was her inner obligation. And so I had to do what a lot of dancers have said to me they do, which is to dig more deeply into yourself and just find it in there and get it and do it. And that is how she inspired me, because that's the kind of person she was.
That's phenomenal. Thank you so much. I think that's a great place to conclude. I'm Victoria Phillips, and I'm here with Neil Baldwin. And please run to your local bookstore or your computer and buy this wonderful biography of Martha Graham. Thank you so much.